Thanks for listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Andrea Lorien, one of the producers on the show, and what you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. Our region sometimes gets a bit of a ribbing for its homogeneity. It's pretty sparsely populated, and Vermont is also one of the least diverse states in the country. But if you travel back in time a couple hundred years, the region around Lake Champlain was known to be a complex and vibrant borderland. The lake created a physical divide between groups of native peoples and between New France and New England. It was the home of adventurous settlers, trappers, traders, colonial soldiers, and entrepreneurs. Two Franklin County authors, Jason Barney and Christine Eldred, have brought together stories of the Lake Region and its contributions to American history. Their book is called The Hidden History of Lake Champlain. Jason Barney is a history teacher. He was awarded the 2023 Vermont History Teacher of the Year Award and was also a semifinalist for Vermont Teacher of the Year in 2022. Jason, welcome.
Thanks for having us on, and thanks for the great intro. That was a very kind description of the book.
Oh, glad to hear it. Well, yes, we're also joined by Christine Eldred, a librarian, genealogist, and writer. She's published numerous articles and guides to preserving and defending intellectual freedom in school libraries. Christine, welcome.
Thank you.
And you two are a married couple and
writing duo.
Yes.
I love that. All right, so tell me how the idea for this book first came about. Jason, you've written four books about local history?
Yeah, now? So this is the fourth book. The first three were different veins exploring different parts of Vermont's history or local Franklin County history. And I wanted to do something that the publisher would be interested in. And usually I talk with Christine about what some of the ideas that I can research or that she can help me research, because with the first three books, there's quite a bit of research in there that Christine doesn't get an author byline on. But for this book, I wanted to just take a look at Lake Champlain and try to emphasize the fact that Vermont is not provincial, that Vermont and Lake Champlain have a very unique and storied history, and made the pitch to the history press, and they jumped on it.
Mm. And when you first started having conversations with Jason about this book, Christine, what were you thinking? What were your experiences like working together on research before?
It's funny how people ask that often.
Well, not many of us are writing books with our spouses.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a rare relationship.
Well, the funny thing is that we sort of have, you know, when we talked about it, Jason has a very chronological mind. Mm. You know, as a historian, that makes a lot of sense. And I'm interested in themes. I'm interested in stories and people, the decisions that they make. You know, why would somebody decide to migrate? Why did they come to across, you know, the ocean to a place that it is wilderness? And then why did they or their descendants decide to move a little further, and so on? So I'm interested in those things. And when we originally talked about this book, we kind of tried to figure out how are we going to meld these things. And eventually we just kind of sorted out topics. And Jason's written so much local history, and he also teaches a local history class at Missisquoi Valley Union. So he has a really strong depth of knowledge in certain areas that he's really interested in. Mm-hmm. So it became very natural for us to kind of pick our topics.
Yeah. Well, let's dive into some of this hidden history. And listeners, we would love for you to join this conversation as well. What's your favorite historic place to visit along Lake Champlain? Do you know a unique story about the lake's history that you'd like to share? You can give us a call at 800-639-2211. You can also send us an email to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. So this book begins not with man-made structures or stories, but with stories of the lake and the land around it itself. Christine, tell us a little bit more about what we should know about this region.
Yeah, I I decided to, I wanted to write the natural history chapter because I love nature and I love the beauty of this area, being by the water, the play of the light on the mountains, watching the trees in all their beautiful states, you know, even bare in the winter or when they get the bright green leaves. And I've wondered a lot of times, what was it like when the Europeans first arrived here before we made such a heavy imprint on this territory, before we started, you know, mining and building and all those things. So that was, it was started with the question of what was here when the Europeans arrived, what was it like? And what makes this area so appealing? I mean, I think most people do find this like a very spectacularly beautiful area. So I wanted to look into how the area formed, and it's really fascinating because we're between two mountain ranges, the Green Mountains and the Adirondacks, and they're ancient. So all of that is interesting, and knowing that there was a saltwater ocean here, a sea, that we have traces of coral reef that you can see in Isle of Mott, that they have found sea creatures such as seals and whales and, you know, those kinds of things in the area. It gives you a much bigger scope of just how ancient this area is.
Mm. And then as settlers from Europe started to arrive here, the land and the buildings upon it, they started to shift, things started to grow. Jason, what were some of the earliest marks on the landscape from these European colonizers?
Well, you've got the French colonizing New Quebec, New France, north of us, and you've got the English settling all along the eastern seaboard. And those two countries have historically, or had been historically, at war for a very, very long period of time. And as the two colonial groups moved inland, as the French moved south and as the English moved north, they started to fight here as well. And some of the first structures that are on Lake Champlain are wooden forts that are in the area of Fort Ticonderoga. Fort Ticonderoga does get built, and that's part of the French and Indian War. But the chapter on the forts, those buildings have a long history, and you can still see them today. Fort Ticonderoga, at one point in time, I believe it was up until the 1930s, had really fallen into disrepair. So the fort that we see today is something that has been almost totally reconstructed. Crown Point, people can drive through that location on the New York side of the lake and still see some of the structures of the forts that were there. And then as you get further north, something that I do like to draw attention to, and not a lot of people know about it, is Fort Montgomery on the New York side of the lake.
What is that?
So if you are leaving Alberg and you're heading west over the Rouses Point Bridge, just chucked right next to the Canadian border, there's a pile of rocks that some people would see and say, oh, that must have been an old fort at one point in time. It was never used during a time period of war. It was the United States deciding to put a almost a physical structure on the lake because lake had been an invasion route during the French and Indian War. The lake had been an invasion route during the Revolutionary War, and the lake had been an invasion route during the War of 1812. So colonial leaders, American leaders, said the best way to prevent that from ever happening again is to build a huge fort. And I believe it started in 1817. It was a massive project. It had various stops and restarts. And today, when people drive by, you can see that the south and the east walls have pretty much fallen into the lake, and much of the building has been scavenged. But it's still there. Mm. And there's also actually another fort that is just north of the border called Île-Noire, and that is probably about the size of Fort Ticonderoga, but it just does not get a lot of press because it's just over the Canadian border.
Hmm. And this fort you were describing, did it work? Did it stop invaders?
Well, thankfully, relations between the United States and England started to get better throughout the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s. It was still not great, even up until the Civil War. But there were U.S. presidents who came to Lake Champlain specifically to take a look at what was being built there. After the St. Albans raid, there were American soldiers that had been stationed there that were used on the border to make sure that there weren't any other incursions coming down. So it was used, but it ends up being a footnote compared to Ticonderoga and Crown Point.
Mm. So back then, it was this important hub, this big building project. Today, as you said, it is a pile of rocks. How do you get people excited, especially like the students that you teach, Jason, excited about this, you know, what is quite literally an old pile of rocks?
Yeah. So I can be kind of adventurous when it comes to asking for people's permission to visit their property. So the class that I teach, or one of the classes that I teach up at Missisquoi Valley Union, is an Abnaki and local history course. And there's so much history up there.
Yeah.
And part of the writing that I've done and the books and my teaching, it's just trying to get students from Franklin County to understand that their neck of the woods is not out in the middle of nowhere, that we are intimately linked to history all over the place. So right now, I do have a couple of field trips where we go to Alberg from Swanton, and there's a little bit of travel time involved. But I would love to contact the owners of Fort Montgomery and have my students go and take a look at that fort. So I understand that it's actually privately owned now, and some folks from New York purchased it. And the rumor is that at some point in time they would like to have a resort or something there. But I think that may be more local speculation than anything else. I don't know the owners, but I would
if
love
you
to
are
the call.
Owners of Fort Montgomery, you could call it at 800-639-2211 and let Jason Barty and his students come on your property. And Jason, I'm glad you brought up the possibility of a resort being built there, because Lake Champlain is known for these historic resorts that lined the edge of the lake. Christine, you wrote a chapter about these resorts, right? What are some of the most notable ones, or ones that really caught your fancy?
Yeah, it was fun to write the chapter on major hotels, and in fact, that's probably going to be something we want to focus on in a next book, because there's a bit of glamour to that era, and these large buildings were so impressive. And
what era are we talking about? Is this 1800s?
Yeah, 1900s? The end of the night. So it was, you know, after train travel allowed people to come out of the cities. Of course, you could take steamships and things like that. So it was when those kind of new transportation options were available. And at the same time, there had been a lot of out-migration in Vermont and rural places, you know, upstate New York and so on. And so for communities on the lake, this was a new economy that they really wanted to grow and encourage. And in the cities, there was a belief that, you know, the mountains were healthy, that the air was clean, that if you were unwell or you had tuberculosis, for instance, or any type of chronic illness, that going to the cool air of the mountains would maybe cure you, if not, you know, at least keep you well. So some of them were health resorts, and the town of Sheldon was known for its springs, its local springs that the water was bottled and shipped. But they also built these massive hotels where people would come on the train and drink the mineral springs and bathe in the mineral springs and so on. And then the lake itself was a draw. The Adirondacks had, has a very still storied history of big hotels and resort areas. And it allowed both New York and Vermont to develop their own style of tourism. And, you can still see traces of it today, although most of the large hotels eventually burned down.
Mm.
But. Yeah.
And a number of presidents came to visit the region, too. Were they coming for the resorts or for official business?
Yeah, the most notable one has to be McKinley, who came up in the 1890s. I believe it's 1897 and 1899. But he spends basically the month of August and then September vacationing at the Champlain Hotel over in Plattsburgh. And it's pretty notable because he's the sitting president. He comes up with his wife. The manager of the hotel knows that they're coming, so they actually ask the president's staff, what colors do you want the room? What sort of flowers do you want? And so they're up here, and they're driving through the streets of Plattsburgh and hoping that they don't get recognized. They're visiting some of the barracks over in Plattsburgh, visiting some of the troops. And he's up here for that one summer, but then he comes back. And that hotel becomes known as the capital of the North, because you think that the president of the United States needs to be in Washington to conduct official business, but he would actually bring his secretary of state, his secretary of defense, and they would conduct official business from the hotel in Plattsburgh, to the point where the Canadian ambassador would come down and meet with them. And Roosevelt is actually in Isle of Mott, or on Isle of Mott, when McKinley gets assassinated. So he receives word that he's about to become president of the United States up in Isle of Mott, and immediately has to leave shortly after that.
Mm. Wow. Okay, so FDR and McKinley,
yep,
right there. Today, we are learning about one of America's most historic waterways, Lake Champlain, site of enormous forts, colonial villages, shipwrecks, and resorts. Our guests are the authors of the book Hidden History of Lake Champlain, Christine Eldred and Jason Barney. If you know a fun historical fact about Lake Champlain, or you think you can stump our authors about its history, give us a call at 800-639-2211. And I should also correct myself, since I know our history buff listeners are many. Before the break, I mentioned FDR. I meant to say Theodore Roosevelt when we were talking about the presidential history of Lake Champlain. In the depths of Lake Champlain, there are a number of very fascinating shipwrecks which are covered in this book. Which of you two wrote the chapter on the shipwrecks?
That was Jason.
Jason, tell us about what's below the depths.
Well, so I think first we have to give credit where credit is due. The Lake Champlain Maritime Museum down in the Vergennes area, they have done a lot of great work. In the late 1990s and early 2000s, they did a Lake Champlain maritime survey of the depths of Lake Champlain, and that involved basically taking sonar readings of the bottom of the lake for most of the length of Lake Champlain. And they were looking for whatever shipwrecks they could find, but I think they were surprised with the number of shipwrecks. I think the number is about 300, or at least 300, that they were able to find. And most of those are ones that are probably at a depth that they can't do the amount of research that they would like to do. But I also have used shipwrecks as a way to sort of tease my students in the classroom, because I think when people think of shipwrecks, they think of the Titanic or they think of a pirate ship,
right,
somewhere out in the ocean. But it's, and this is part of the way I teach too, it's just neat to be able to have a conversation with a student and have them think about or understand that you don't have to send your imagination halfway across the world to think about a shipwreck, that we have these right here in our own backyard. So I relied heavily on what the Lake Champlain Maritime Museum had already done, and their focus ended up being a lot on steamships, because so many people get involved in the steamship history, and what the Shelburne Museum has is so available for everybody to look at. But there's also canal boats, and there's military craft. And when you get into the specifics, there are certain areas of the lake that are basically shipwreck graveyards. One would be Shelburne Bay, just south of Burlington. There are 12 or 13 old steamship wrecks that are just below the water. And then when you get out into Burlington Bay, into the area of Colchester, there are three or four other really, really fascinating wrecks. One of them is one of the early ferries. It's a horse ferry that was not propelled by steam, not propelled by sail, but they actually had horses walking in a mechanical structure in the center of the boat, and that would power the paddles to get the boat moving. So, and the Maritime Museum has done a great job advertising their work too, because on their website they have some 3D video, but they have a lot of images of what those shipwrecks actually look like.
And if that horse ferry is now a shipwreck, I fear for the fate of those horses that were upon it.
Yes.
Oof. Are you able, I don't know if this is part of your research, have you ever done any scuba diving or gone down below the depths to see any of these, or more of a museum guy?
No, but that's the sort of question that I would ask my students to push their imagination on. And just like the question about, is it kind of weird for a history teacher to call somebody up and say, can I visit your property? A couple of the guest speakers that I've had in class actually ended up being scuba divers. And there was something that made it into the book, one of the later chapters. There's local lore up in Missisquoi Bay. That's the furthest northeast section of the lake, and that's the area where Swanton and Highgate are. There's local lore that there's a cannon somewhere up in those waters. And I worked in that area for 13 years, and I'm very familiar with that area of the lake. And it irritated me that here I am writing local history books and studying all of this stuff, and I had never heard of or never even researched. And so I need to give credit to Mr. Dexter from the Highgate Historical Society. He's the one who initially approached me about that question. But I invited some scuba divers up, and they donated their time. We didn't have to pay them at all. And it wasn't as professional as what the Lake Champlain Maritime Museum would do. And I was on the boat. I wasn't one of the scuba divers, but I think I took some pretty good photos. And but we didn't find the cannon, so the search is still there, and my students can still ask that question about whether or not there's a cannon up there. But there's also shipwrecks in Missisquoi Bay, too, that we can that I can latch my students' imaginations onto.
Yeah, it's still good adventure, nonetheless. Christine, was there a particular story or place that you were very excited to go on a research adventure of your own for when you were working on this book?
I was really interested in, I wrote the chapter on the presence of the French era in the Champlain Valley, and I was interested in that, sort of from a genealogical perspective, and a historical perspective, because, of course, French culture is interwoven in Vermont, but yet we don't always see it. And so I was interested to see what traces still remain of the French colonial era, how they were integrated into the area when the border was kind of more porous and so on. So that was a really interesting time period to research and to discover.
And you studied genealogy,
yes,
right? Right.
Yes.
How did that focus of yours factor into this book? Did it come through in any ways?
Well, it did, in the sense that I love to research. I'm a librarian, and I got into genealogy because I was just, I was always one of those kids who wanted to hear from my grandparents. What was it like when you were a kid? Where did you live? What did you do? All of those kinds of things. And that's really social history that really excites me and gets me. I'm always, when Jason referred to me doing research, I'm always looking up people that he mentions or trying to find information in some of the more social history resources, like old newspapers and local history books and things like that. So, I think the story of people, the choices that they make, the beliefs that they hold, all of those things are really fascinating.
Yeah. Oh, those phrases you were just using reminded me of one of the most fascinating parts of the book to me, which is on the Millerites. who can tell me about the Millerites? Now I'm the teacher, Jason.
So you have to have a little bit of an understanding of 19th century religion.
Okay.
The country and the area was a lot more religious than it is today. But Mr. Miller is in the area of upstate New York, but he's right across from Rutland. And throughout the late 1820s and through the 1830s, he's going to different pastors and he's basically thinking about the Book of Revelations and he's wondering when the end of the world is going to come. So as you get into the 1830s, he decides to go public with a date, and it happens to be somewhere in the range of 1844.
Oh,
and
okay.
The reason why that chapter's in the book is because as soon as Miller comes up with a date, he gets a following. People start to listen to what he's saying, and they want to hear his predictions. And I initially had been exposed to this when I took a summer college class with Don Harpster down at the College of St. Joseph's, and we actually visited what they call Ascension Rock, and that's where some of the Millerites ended up waiting for the end of the world. But the reason why it's in the book is because he starts to, as he gets a following, he takes his word to different towns and different communities. And he starts off down in the Rutland area, in the Orwell, et cetera. But very quickly, as the word of his prediction spreads, he's on the steamships on Lake Champlain, traveling up to Plattsburgh. He's going to Canada. He's, in fact, I think he ministered in Richford at one point in time. So Miller continues to minister, and the date approaches, and lo and behold, the end of the world does not come.
True.
He refines his date, but at that point in time, he had been laughed at, probably appropriately in some quarters, but people again waited, and the end of the world didn't come again. So
long walk down Ascension Rock.
Yeah. So, and I wrote that chapter probably somewhat sarcastically, just because in 2024, 2025, the concept of somebody assigning a date to when the end of the world is going to come, and that the end of the world might start in the Champlain Valley, was kind of a unique thing to think about.
There's a bit of hubris in there, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, let's go to the phones. We have Elena calling in from Jericho. Elena, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I used to work over at Shelburne Farms, and we used to hear the story about Teddy Roosevelt being up here, staying with the Wimps at Shelburne Farms when McKinley was killed, and now I just heard that he was in Lamotte, so I'm just trying to get the story straight.
Thanks, Elena.
Yeah, so I don't know the names of the families that are down here, but in the research that I had uncovered, so McKinley wasn't in Plattsburgh when he was assassinated. He was in New York, and the story that ends up in the book is that he's in Isle Lamotte at the home of Lieutenant Governor Fisk, and there were fish and game clubs that were meeting up there, and several people from Swanton and Elberg, and in fact, a lot of Vermonters were there. And he gets the phone call. And then I think afterward, it is a couple of days afterward, that he goes down the lake on, I believe the name of the steam shot is the Elfrida. And I think he's down in the Shelburne area, but I don't have enough information to further the caller's question.
Hmm. Well, thanks so much for calling in, Elena. I can't imagine what it's like to just be driving around in this area with the depth of knowledge that the two of you have. Are you ever like in the car with someone or having dinner with friends and they're like, how do you know so much about this area? Or stop telling us when we bring up a certain place.
I don't know about that. When we drive around together, Jason's office often pointing off and saying, oh, there used to be a spring house there, or this is where the barracks were, we think, in 1812, or, he sees ghosts, you could say.
Would you agree?
All over the landscape.
The rest of the world doesn't drive around like that?
I do love a good game of used to be. So tell us a little bit more about what is within the lake. Later in the show, we're going to be talking about Lake Sturgeon. And I know most of this book focuses on the people and the human history around Lake Champlain, though not all of it. Is Champ in there?
We did not include Champ. I mean, Champ has been really thoroughly covered by other authors, you know, well. I mean, I think we all find it a charming story. No
historical fact, though.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up because we have signed their contract for the next book, and the next book specifically is going to be on the grand hotels of Lake Champlain. And I love the area of Missisquoi Bay and Highgate and the Tyler Place and the Highgate Manor. And in that research for that book, the original hotel that predates the Tyler Place is called the Franklin House. Anyway, so there was a reference in, I believe it's the 1870s, 1880s. There were two women from Quebec who were out on a boat in the northern section of the lake, and they saw Champ. And it made the statewide press. But their account was extremely vivid. They said that the head of the creature that they saw was the size of a barrel and that it was at least 20 feet long. And as it started to swim away, its flippers were as loud as a paddle boat. And so I just made sure to footnote that, and that'll be in the next book.
Mm. Yes, tell us a little bit more, Christine, about this next book and what you're hoping to uncover.
Yeah, well, we wanted to talk more about the hotels and the tourism industry, which is, you know, very interwoven with how this area developed. And Jason has a particular interest in a place known as the Highgate Manor, which many locals are familiar with. It's sort of quite an impressive building that has a very varied history. And I'm going to be focusing on a lot of the human stories, researching people who owned or developed these sites, people who maybe worked at the hotels, who the travelers were, those kinds of things. So we're looking forward to it. It's a fun topic. It's fun to go really in depth into something. This book, Hidden History of Lake Champlain, you know, touches on a lot of different areas. So it's kind of fun to focus in on something really more intensively.
Mm. And are the two of you doing any events for the book or talks where people can come meet you and learn more?
So Thursday night, I'll be at the meeting for the Swanton Enhancement Committee. And they just wanted a 20-minute presentation on the history of Swanton. I don't think I'll be able to contain myself to 20 minutes. But, and then the Episcopal Church, which is St. John's Episcopal Church, which is just down from the Highgate Manor. They asked for a little bit of information in a presentation or two on the history of that church, the Allen family. Has a pew with their name on it in the front row. And then the Lake Champlain Maritime Museum has invited us to come down in the spring to open up their season. So.
And where can you buy the book?
You can get it locally. Barnes & Noble has it. Eloquent Page in St. Albans carries it. I've seen it sometimes at places like Kinney Drugs or drugstores often have a rack of local history books. Where else? Amazon, of course. And you can order directly from the History Press.
Phoenix Books,
yeah. Okay.
Jason Varney and Christine Eldred are the authors of Hidden History of Lake Champlain from the History Press. Thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
In the depths of Lake Champlain swim huge prehistoric fish called lake sturgeon. They're one of the largest North American freshwater fish, and they can live more than 150 years. In many of the northern states where they live, like Vermont, they are listed as endangered. Here to tell us more about these giants and the efforts to protect them is Lee Simard. He's a fisheries biologist with Vermont Fish and Wildlife and is based out of their Essex Junction office. Hey, Lee.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're so glad you're with us. Tell us a little bit more about what a lake sturgeon looks like for those who have not seen them in the big tanks in the Echo Center in Burlington or caught one.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Sturgeon are noteworthy because of their looks. They're a prehistoric fish, so they have a tail kind of like a shark, thick leathery skin. But what's really noteworthy about them is their size, is they can regularly be 3 to 5 feet long, often exceeding 6, maybe 8 feet, and be up to 300 pounds. The largest ones we've caught in Lake Champlain in recent years as a department are over 150 pounds and over 6 feet long. So picture an average-sized human swimming around in Lake Champlain.
And they can live for a really long time too, right?
They can, yeah. So the literature documents them up to 150 years old. Some of the handful of fish that we've aged here in Lake Champlain are closing in on 100 years. I think we had one late 70s, like nearly 80 years old. So they can certainly grow a long time and live a long time in Lake Champlain.
Mm. Yeah, and where else in the state do they live besides the lake itself?
Yeah, so they're in Vermont. They're only found in Lake Champlain, but they'll spawn in historically 4 different tributaries, the Missisquoi, Lamoille, and Winooski rivers, as well as Otter Creek. There were never any historic documentations of them going into New York tributaries to spawn.
Mm. And their habitat has shrunk since humans did what humans do. Tell us about that. How did the changes that people made to this region affect lake sturgeon and their habitat?
Yeah, dams are one of those noteworthy features on many of our rivers. And on a couple of rivers, spawning rivers for sturgeon, specifically the Missisquoi and Lamoille rivers, those lowermost dams are lower than the historic fall lines and cut lake sturgeon off from much of their historic spawning ground. So having those dams prevents them from accessing a lot of spawning habitat, which ideally they would be using to help maintain or, at this point, restore their populations.
Yeah. So these dam removal projects have long been considered by biologists to be the best possible habitat restoration for species like sturgeon. But there have been some that haven't been able to move forward. Like there was, I think about 10 or 15 years ago, this push to remove the dam in Swanton, and Fish and Wildlife was on board with that. But Swanton officials were really against it. They said the dam is very, very important to their town's history. Do you still view that project and similar proposals worth pursuing to help restore sturgeon populations in the state?
Certainly. I think the department regularly identifies the Swanton Dam as probably one of the best restoration projects that could be done to benefit fisheries in Lake Champlain. Not only lake sturgeon, but walleye, red horse suckers, salmon could all access other habitat further upstream to spawn. So that's certainly something that's at the forefront of the department. But like any dam removal, as you mentioned, dams are owned by individuals or towns in this case. So it's up to the owner of the dam to make that final decision.
Mm. What are some of the other reasons besides these dams that lake sturgeon are listed as endangered? Were they overfished like other species have been?
Yeah, so there was a historic commercial fishery for lake sturgeon, in part for their flesh, but a lot of it was caviar. So the late 1800s through early 1900s, records show a couple hundred sturgeon were being harvested every year. And that continued until about the 1967 when the commercial fishery was ended. Other factors, though, contribute to their decline. Noteworthy is sea lamprey. So sea lamprey are a parasitic fish that latches onto the side of other fish and sucks their fluids out. People often think of them targeting salmon or lake trout in the lake, but other species, including sturgeon, are targets. And we know that juvenile lake sturgeon are especially susceptible to sea lamprey attacks and causes them to die. So that's one of our thoughts about why sturgeon, after being knocked back, haven't been able to recover to a high level is because of high levels of sea lamprey. So sea lamprey control, again, in part was directed towards salmon and lake trout, but is having those other benefits for lake sturgeon as well.
If you have a question about lake sturgeon or have seen one close up, call in and tell us about it. 800-639-2211 is our number. Did you say that sea lamprey suck the liquid out of fish that they're attached to, like little vampires?
That's right. Often people call them the vampires of the lake. They have a special tooth in the middle of their mouth that they'll suction onto the side of a fish, drill a hole in the side of the fish with that tooth and suck fluids out of it. If enough attacks happen to a single fish, then that fish will likely die.
Oof. What a way to go.
Yeah.
speaking of invasive species, the round goby is also a concern for lake sturgeon and other parts of the lake's ecosystem, right?
That's right. Yeah. Round goby, they're a small fish that lives on the bottom, but they're highly prolific. When they move into an area, there's literally thousands of them in a small space, and they eat things on the bottom, including fish eggs. And so that's one of our big concerns for a number of species in Lake Champlain and the overall health of the ecosystem is if round goby get into Lake Champlain, what's that going to mean for a lot of our species?
So they're not here yet.
They're not here yet, but they're knocking on the door from both the north, coming in from through the Richelieu River from the St. Lawrence, but also the south through the Champlain Canal. So there's a lot of folks on both sides of the lake and a bunch of agencies working to try to keep round goby from getting here.
And the ways to do that are what? Cleaning boats?
Yeah, there's a lot going on from the south coming through the Champlain Canal. There's a series of locks that are owned by an agency in New York. And so trying to work with those folks to figure out a plan to manage that lock system to try to inhibit movement of round goby. But also there's a whole list of other invasive species knocking on the door as well.
Mm. So Fish and Wildlife has this special project to help you all track lake sturgeon and study them using what's called acoustic telemetry. Can you tell us more about it?
Yeah, that's right. So despite lake sturgeon being 6 feet long and swimming around the lake for a long time, people don't see them very often, and we don't know exactly where they go. So what we've been doing for the past 10 years or so in Lake Champlain is trying to catch some lake sturgeon, and then we surgically implant a tag into it. And each tag has a unique identifier, and it sends a signal out every 2 minutes. And when that tag gets within about half a mile of a network of receivers that are throughout the lake, so listening devices specially designed to listen for those tags, it'll hear that tag and log it. And we can then go offload all those receivers and see where those tagged fish have been swimming.
Mm. Wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah, it's really exciting. Often as fisheries biologists, we're managing at a population level, and you estimate, okay, there are this many fish in this area, looking at different metrics at that level. But suddenly now we're watching the behavior of an individual. And so you're trying to look at that behavior between different fish and know, is that representative of the whole population, or is that just a fish that wanted to do something different?
Do you ever give them names?
I don't. I've gotten pretty good at remembering their numbers, though. So 9642 is a special fish, the first one I tagged. So.
So in the spring, sturgeon come into the rivers to spawn, as you described. If a person happens to catch a lake sturgeon or see one, what exactly do you do? What can people do to make sure that we're keeping this population as safe as possible?
Yeah. So lake sturgeon, as you mentioned, are a state endangered species. And like all endangered species in the state, it's illegal to take or harass or in any way interfere with the behavior of an endangered species. And that includes catching one. A lot quite frequently we hear of people incidentally catching lake sturgeon in the spring as they're coming into spawn, especially in the Winooski River. But simply having that fish on your line is an illegal act. We can't control that, though, and we recognize anglers can't control that. But there are certain steps that we ask that they do. As soon as you have a fish on your line that you know is a lake sturgeon, cut your line so that you aren't interfering with its behavior and let it swim on. Or if
better to cut the line than to try to take out the hook.
In the challenges, a 6-foot fish in a river, it a lot of people are fishing with lighter lines, lighter tackle.
It might take your line.
We've heard anglers say, it took us an hour and a half to land that fish. And that's not what we want to be happening to these fish. They're there to spawn. Those spawning fish are what we need to help recover the population. So other things people can do is if you hear of people catching a sturgeon in one area or you happen to hook into one, maybe fish somewhere else or consider using a barbless hook, for instance, if you're fishing with bait. Just other these techniques to be aware that we want to minimize our impact on sturgeon. But we also recognize there's a lot of other fish in the river at that time of year, and we want people to go out and be able to still enjoy fishing for those other species.
Is there any chance that someone might have a encounter with a lake sturgeon while ice fishing in the winter?
Yeah, we have had a few reports. The Missisquoi River spawning population in our acoustic telemetry project, that's been one that previous biologist Chet McKenzie couldn't ever catch a fish from the Missisquoi population to tag. And the only knowledge we had to go on about where to set our nets to try to capture sturgeon was a couple of reports from ice anglers who said, hey, we caught one here while ice fishing for walleye. That's where we went and started setting some of our nets, and eventually we're able to catch a couple right there. So, but now we can track those fish, see where they're going at different times of the year, and try to target other fish through that tracking.
Mm. Lee, since you've studied lake sturgeon so closely, leave us with one more interesting tidbit about this species that we haven't covered yet today.
Yeah, that's a great question. The fact that they live so long also means that they don't mature sexually and start to reproduce until they're quite old. So a male may not start reproducing until it's 12, 15 years old, and a female may not be until it's 15 or 20 years old. And then that female only come back to spawn every 3 to 5 years. So to me, what's so fascinating is what I'm doing as a biologist now is going to have population impacts for the biologist that comes after me. I'm still pretty new in my career, but it's going to be after I retire that the fish being spawned now are then going back up the river to spawn.
Lee Simard is a fisheries biologist with Vermont Fish and Wildlife. Lee, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been great learning about lake sturgeon.